murder having married a planter's daughter, and the doctor her unacknowledged mixed-race half-sister. The white daughter refuses to acknowledge the mixed-raced one, whom she understands to be the child of a liaison between their father and the black housekeeper he took up with after the death of his white wife. The two daughters remain connected, however, by the question of inheritance. Going through their father's papers, the white daughter finds a will. The will acknowledges both daughters, leaving the bulk of the estate to the white one, but settling some money on the mixed-race daughter as well. The white daughter is enraged by this will, which she takes to be the irrational caprice of an irrational man, and she burns it, only to discover, after she has done so, that another document remains, a marriage certificate. The marriage certificate reveals what the white sister could not have imagined possible, that her father had actually legally married the housekeeper, and that the mixed-race daughter is therefore also legitimate and thus deserving of half the estate. Until that point in the novel, Reconstruction had been mentioned only to be dismissed, as when one white character describes it as a time when the air was full of liberty and equal rights and all that abolition claptrap. But it turns out that the equal rights claptrap still holds force in the present day. Interracial marriage has since been outlawed, but it was legal during Reconstruction, and marriages contracted during that time remain legal still. Indeed, the knowledge that her father's liaison with her housekeeper was actually a legal marriage prompts the white daughter to acknowledge something she must have already known, that her neighbor, a white planter, is also legally married to a black woman and remains married to her to that day. And so where the house behind the cedars places Reconstruction in a century's worth of unchanging racial violence, Marrow of Tradition imagines a Reconstruction that is somehow still, in some ways, in effect. Pauline Hopkins. After a young adulthood devoted to playwriting and performing as a member of Hopkins Colored Troubadours, Pauline E. Hopkins re-entered public life in middle age as the editor of the Colored American magazine. And it's worth spending a second to talk about the Colored American magazine because it basically exemplifies exactly the kind of indexicality and instrumentality that Ken Warren says is so typical of literature of this period. The Color American had been founded in 1901 with two intertwined aspirations. The first was literary. The Colored American sought to be the equivalent of the Atlantic Monthly. It sought to further the development of Afro-American art and literature. And it did so in part by celebrating what had already been achieved, as when it published an article describing the Negro exhibit at the 1900 International Exhibition in Paris, where books by colored authors were on display, along with various handicrafts and portraits of race leaders. But it also did so by republishing new works of fiction and poetry, many of them by Pauline Hopkins. The magazine's other aspiration was political. It sought, as its prospectus announced, to encourage its readers to assert their racial rights as men and to demand their rights as citizens, particularly in the face of recent Southern attempts to crush the manhood and self-respect out of the Negro. And so what's going on in the pages of the Colored American magazine is precisely a political debate about how best to respond to Jim Crow. And what we see is that there is a consensus of opinion that, you know, Jim Crow must be combated. There's continual debate about methods, and Pauline Hopkins is always on the most radical side of all of these debates, in particular in her contempt for the Republican Party's failure to defend African Americans and her growing disaffection with electoral politics. Hopkins thus wrote, as Warren would have it, both instrumentally and indexically against Jim Crow. And indeed, she offers, as I've said, a particularly clear example of Jim Crow writing. And in her non-fictional writing, she is equally committed as Chestnut had been to defending Reconstruction and to celebrating African-American officeholding. Hopkins wrote a series of biographical essays entitled Famous Men of the Negro Race that placed officeholders like Senators John Mercer Langston and Blanche K. Bruce alongside other race leaders, among them Frederick Douglass, Toussaint Louverture, Booker T. Washington, and W.E.B. Du Bois. Hopkins acknowledged the attacks made on these officeholders in order to better defend them. In one of her essays, for instance, she would defend Congressman Robert Brown Elliott from charges of corruption. Hopkins' fiction also advances a campaign against Jim Crow. Defense of Reconstruction through defending officers. Move on. Her fictional writing also advanced the campaign against Jim Crow, but Her fictional writings are also, as we have come to expect, more troubled in their relation to Reconstruction. Of Hopkins' four novels, two are particularly significant in this regard because they attempt to encompass the whole 19th century and thus must bring Reconstruction into their ambit. One of these novels, Hagar's Daughters, begins on a slave plantation in Maryland just prior to the Civil War, and it stops suddenly, only to begin again in the 1880s. When the novel resumes, it is set in Washington, D.C., among a seemingly unrelated set of characters. It gradually becomes clear, however, that the postbellum characters are actually the antebellum characters under different names. The names are different, but the roles are remarkably the same. The woman who had been the housekeeper on the plantation has become a cleaner in the Department of the Treasury, and the head of the department turns out to be the old plantation owner in disguise. Reconstruction, it turns out, has made little difference in their lives, and this is perhaps why it's better avoided. When Hagar's Daughters does come near Reconstruction, it quickly shies away. We can see this when the novel pauses to celebrate a real-life black soldier, Robert B. Smalls. Smalls, the narrator reminds us, was a South Carolinian slave who seized a Confederate warship, sailed it through a blockade, and delivered it to the Union Navy. The narrator calls this one of the most daring and heroic adventures of the war, and the novel later recalls other instances of black valor at Fort Wagner, at Fort Pillow, and at Honey Hill. What the narrator does not tell us is that Smalls, who was famous indeed for being a soldier, was equally famous for being an office holder. After the Civil War, he went on to become an unusually prominent figure in South Carolina political life, serving for 7 years in the South Carolina State Legislature before being elected to 5 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives. It is striking that Hopkins did not mention any of this, particularly since the novel was being serialized right alongside the famous men of the Negro race. To be sure, Smalls had been found guilty of corruption, albeit in a trial that even conservative Democrats later admitted had been unfair. But Hopkins had been willing to defend Eliot against similar charges in her nonfiction writing. In her novel, however, it seems that there is no place for African-American office holders. Contending Forces, too, begins on a slave plantation in the antebellum period. A third of the way through, it too suddenly stops and then begins once again in the postbellum period, and the rest of the novel is set in Boston at the turn of the century, among the grandchildren of the characters we had first seen. Reconstruction is thus neatly evaded once more. But while Hagar's Daughters leaves Reconstruction entirely unmentioned, Contending Forces tries to bridge the gap between antebellum and postbellum, and it does so by conjuring up what most typified Reconstruction for Hopkins, the readiness of the federal government to intervene on behalf of African Americans. The novel's main characters, the ones we meet in turn-of-the-century Boston, had long ago been deprived of their rightful inheritance. Their grandmother and grandfather, with whom the novel began, had owned a plantation, but they were killed by an organized gang of poor whites and neighboring planters who had used the grandmother's ambiguous racial identity to justify seizing the plantation for themselves and selling the children into slavery. When the novel's main characters, the grandchildren of the dispossessed, learn of this past, they decide to sue the United States government on the very weak grounds that the federal government was somehow responsible for the actions of a vigilante band operating in one of the southern states before the war. The novel acknowledges the weakness of this claim by emphasizing that the Supreme Court decides not to hear this case in public, but the justices nonetheless do agree to sit privately and render judgment in Smith v. Washington. And when they do, they return the lost plantation to their rightful heirs, along with $150,000 in damages. Nor is this judgment seen as anomalous. An earlier suit against the federal government by another branch of this family had resulted in damages of another $100,000. As it happens, the return of the estates makes no difference in the lives of the characters and is not even referred to again. The entire episode of the Supreme Court case performs no function in the novel's plot, but instead expresses a desire for federal intervention so intense that it reveals itself in implausible fantasy. So what does all this mean? I hope that I've by now persuaded you that Reconstruction presents a real problem for turn-of-the-century African-American authors who defend Reconstruction in their non-fictional writings but show themselves unable to depict it favorably in their fiction, even though their fiction is otherwise being written in the service of political ends. each of these authors can be accounted for in his or her own individual way. So we might say, for instance, that it is Harper's disappointment that women have been excluded from the suffrage and her fear that direct political action will crowd out more indirect social reform that prompt her to depict African-American voters and office holders in such a critical light. And we might say, too, that it is her inexperience at structuring full-length novels that causes her and Iola Leroy to skip over Reconstruction's end. We might say that it is Chestnut's disappointment at never getting the office he had presumed would be his, as well as his more general despair at the failure of Reconstruction to return, that lead him to shy away from the period in his fiction. And we might say that it is Hopkins' frustration with what the government was failing to do to combat Jim Crow that led her to skip over the fact of African-American office holding, even as she imagines that the government intervening in ways that circumvent elections. And yet, to set these three alongside one another is to see the beginnings of a pattern that transcends individual biography. And this pattern extends to other authors of the period as well. It extends to Paul Laurence Dunbar, who offers his own derisive depiction of African-American office holding in a story whose title, Mr. Cornelius Johnson, Office Seeker, foreshadows the minstrel-like humor Dunbar will find in the story of an office holder who triumphantly arrives in the capital city, only to be undone by a corruption he is simply too ignorant to understand. And the pattern also extends to Sutton E. Griggs, whose utopian Imperio and Imperium suggests that Reconstruction never ended. It merely went underground. The young men educated in a freedman's school at the novel's beginning are invited in their adulthood to join a secret government based in Texas, which asserts jurisdiction over all black men and women in the United States. The government mirrors the U.S. government in its structure, but all the offices, like all its citizens, are African American. So it's a utopian fantasy that's essentially Reconstruction. With these examples in mind, we can see that if turn-of-the-century African-American literature is a literature of Jim Crow, it is also, and equally importantly, a literature of Reconstruction. And this point is significant because Jim Crow and Reconstruction offer quite different accounts of the relation between the state and African-Americans, of what activism might entail, and of African-American history more generally. And so I'd like to conclude by elaborating how we might start thinking differently about all three of those things if we keep Reconstruction in mind. So first, African Americans and the state. Under Jim Crow, the state is only oppressive, the force that created and continues to enforce a racial caste system. But during Reconstruction, the state took on an array of roles. The federal government took responsibility for superintending African Americans, at various times guarding them against violence, overseeing the conditions of their labor in terms of their contracts, providing them with various forms of assistance through the Freedmen's Bureau, rations and clothing in the immediate aftermath of the war, shelter, medical care, and education after that. Moreover, with the enfranchisement of African American men and the election of African American office holders, African Americans stood inside as well as outside of the state. This history resonated for authors at the turn of the century who recognized that there once was, and to some extent still is, a particularly intimate if highly fraught relationship between African Americans and the state. This history registers in their fictions. We found it most obviously in fantastic passages that envision the federal government intervening directly to protect individual African American women and men, as when Hopkins imagines the U.S. Supreme Court meeting in secret to right the wrongs done to a single family, or Griggs imagines the U.S. president, this is in another novel, taking a long-distance phone call from a man who is about to be lynched, and the man says, "Are you going to save me?" And the president says, "No," and the man hangs up and gets lynched. Second, it changes the way we think about the nature of African-American activism. Prior to the Civil War, and once again under Jim Crow, African-American activism followed the familiar model of reform. Authors, speakers, and activists of other kinds decried the deplorable present and conjured up a better future in the hope of changing the hearts and minds of those around them, and in turn, by a mechanism that often goes unexplained, somehow changing political and economic relations. But during Reconstruction, a different model of social change prevailed. Changes were imposed from above, through constitutional amendment, through federal and state law, through military decree. And these changes were enacted by a new kind of activist, by men who worked within the state rather than hoping to influence it from without. As a result, African American office holders had access to a power no longer available to activists under Jim Crow, a difference that prompted envy in the authors I'm focusing, but also contempt. Because Reconstruction may have endowed mid-century radicals with a kind of power that turn-of-the-century reformers could only dream of, but it was far from clear to these later reformers what Reconstruction had actually achieved. Indeed, to set the two periods alongside one another is to reveal bitter historical ironies. Turn-of-century reformers were campaigning against Plessy v. Ferguson, even though segregation had been outlawed by the Civil Rights Act of 1875. They were campaigning against lynching, even though the Ku Klux Klan had already been defeated in 1872. They were campaigning against disfranchisement, even though the right to vote had already been secured by the 15th Amendment in 1870. As a consequence of these repetitions, Reconstruction was understood both as the era that had achieved everything and as the era that had achieved nothing at all. And this brings me to the course of African American history. An attention to Jim Crow need not entail any particular view of Reconstruction, but for Warren and for many of his critics, the Reconstruction era is only rarely remarked upon and never properly reckoned with. So the word Reconstruction appears in Warren's book in the first paragraph of the first page, and that's it. Warren's reperiodizing effort divides African American history into three parts. The antebellum period, in which activists understood themselves in universalist or Americanist terms, the Jim Crow period, in which activists understood themselves as African Americans, and the present day, in which activists understand themselves as multi-ethnic or transnational in a myriad of ways. Warren's critics challenge this chronology only to argue that Jim Crow began earlier or lasted longer than Warren admits, and both of those points I think are absolutely correct and need to be made. But in the course of the debate that follows, each side accuses the other of offering a false history. Warren's critics suspect him of wanting to tell a Whiggish story in which racism is gradually replaced by race blindness. Warren sees his critics, in turn, as trying to erase history, replacing it with an eternal present in which slavery is always reverberating with as much force, whether through collective memory or through trauma, as it ever did. In ignoring Reconstruction, Warren, and to some extent his critics, fail to see another story of African American history, ones of both gains and loss. In between slavery and Jim Crow came a time when African Americans had some measure of political power. And if that power was limited, it was real. Real enough that its subsequent loss was mourned by the generation that followed. The gains, the losses, and the mourning should all be of particular interest to us today, it seems to me. For we, too, are living in an era that mourns the loss of recent gains, watching the gradual undoing of a civil rights movement that was called, at the time, the Second Reconstruction. We, too, recall a time when the federal government and the courts took responsibility for the plight of African Americans, and we, too, fantasize about what the courts might do even now, should they so choose. And finally, we, too, find ourselves asking whether an African American office holder, whether he be a congressman or a president, can ever be a race leader as well. In all of these struggles, we might find resources in the writings of those who preceded us. Warren has offered his account of Jim Crow in the hopes of helping us understand how we got to be where we are. Beginning to attend to Reconstruction might help us begin to think about how we can move forward. Thanks.
Get us out of the dark.
Oh, I got it.
Oh, thanks.
Okay. So I am, as you can imagine, thrilled that so many of you know about this Warren debate. We can dive into it.
I have actually two questions. The first has to do, on the one hand, Du Bois and people looking back really felt that the development of African Americans after the trauma of slavery and, the kind of the reign of terror that followed, during Jim Crow, that people had really unrealistic expectations for their kind of full sort of integration into the society. And I think there's a point there. And I was wondering, when you said that the Ku Klux Klan had been defeated in 1872.
Mm-hmm. It comes back.
Don't worry. I mean that, it's very hard to write novels, much less be a politically active novels that you don't want to incite, you don't want to inflame sort of social problems when there's really this like horrible reign of terror. And I think it's interesting, I was interested that there was a depiction of a lynching in Chestnut,
mm-hmm.
because really most of the lynching, it's post-migration literature where you really see, rights depiction and Hughes's flight,
mm-hmm.
which isn't even, I mean, it was very, I'm sure it was very, very difficult to confront.
I'm trying to think of early lynchings. I'm not thinking of autobiography of ex-color, but...
Oh, right, of course.
I'm sorry, you said you had two things you wanted to say.
I guess my two comments were, you know, simply that part of the explanation could be really that it was just very difficult to achieve, I mean, as many, you know, as Du Bois and others were saying, it's very difficult to achieve that level of integration in a very, very short period of time.
So when you say that, you're defending, what is the claim you think you're countering?
Well, this idea that people are selling their votes.
Oh, right. So you're saying, Harper, you're
they
being too hard on these people.
And, you know, they were scared, basically.
Sure. I mean, so one historiographical problem I have all the time is how corrupt were these state governments, really? Because it's very easy to read the discursive history. It's very easy to tell the story I'm telling, which is, wasn't it convenient when at a moment of reunion for whites in the North to be able to say, oh, those governments, they were all a mistake, they're all corrupt. There's also, I think, a lot to say about charges of corruption being used to explain two things which people otherwise have no mental mechanism for dealing with. One is the vastly increased expense of government, right? Mm-hmm. So what you get in, I follow this a lot in South Carolina, and what you get in South Carolina is suddenly the tax base goes down. Because nobody's making any money in South Carolina after the war. And suddenly there's this mandate for public education, so the government's costs have gone dramatically up. So it looks like there's no money in the state treasury. And the convenient way of explaining it is like the Negro stole it, right? But what's going on is a different conception of government, a different conception of taxation. Similarly, I think what's going on, although I could be wrong about this, seems to me that one of the things that happens, the transition out of slavery, is that whole reservoir of capital just goes away, right? So everyone was rich when they had their slaves, and suddenly they're not, right?
And it's after the Civil War, too.
Right, and the infrastructure is devastated, right? So, like, you need a lot of money to build things up. Nobody has any money. Again, where must it have gone? The Yankees must have stolen it, the carpet baggers, right? So there's a way in which charges of corruption serve all kinds of purposes. That said, it would not be unlikely that there was corruption in the South because there was also corruption in, you know...
Tammany Hall,
right? The corruption, it's a corrupt era. I agree with you. What interests me about Harper's criticism of the voters is why it matters to her. The bigger question of how corrupt were these governments really, which is something I think about a lot, and I don't know how to resolve it. If anybody has any insight into that, I would be really... Is there insight?
I know what people have written about it, but...
Yeah.
Which is that it was an era of corruption, right? So, yeah. It's in that context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was there no surviving literature that honored the efforts of the Reconstruction office holders?
So what I wasn't... Okay, so this is how I got into this project. I was reading, I thought I was going to write a book about Reconstruction, a scholarly monograph, which I'm now not going to do. And in the process, I read things like Birth of a Nation, you know, saw Birth of a Nation, whatever, and I thought, at a certain point, I thought, oh, there must be a counter discourse to this. Where can I find it? And so I looked in, you know, the Northern press that had initially supported Reconstruction, and it's not there because they're backing the kind of more moderate-seeming but still anti-Reconstruction stance at that point, the kind of genteel version of it. And then I thought, well, it must be in African-American literature. And then that's why I was really shocked to see this, because I think if you haven't read these works, you may think to yourself, well, you know, sure, but Harper, Hopkins, I mean, they're just depicting, you know, offering complex characterizations. These works are so relentlessly idealizing. Everyone is heroic and wonderful and incredibly beautiful. And so these office holders, these voters stand out in a really striking way. So that was where I got really interested in it. Then I turned, I thought, the office holders themselves, right? And their memoirs are fascinating. And so I didn't talk about them, but one that is fascinating to me symptomatically. So one question for this project is, to what extent is it fair to read symptomatically and to say, you say X, but seriously, clearly what's at issue is your own insecurity about whatever. John Mercer Langston, who becomes a senator briefly and then is driven from office by fraud, writes an autobiography which is a catalog of every... He doesn't mention a single thing he did in office. And so one way of exploring that is to say, well, what does it mean to have political power? Is symbolic power also important, and therefore it doesn't matter what he does in office? He is in office, that is the action. But he doesn't mention what he does in office. What he mentions is he records every complimentary letter he receives upon being elected to anything. And then when he leaves office, he records every single letter he receives thanking him for what he did. So for instance, he gets named ambassador to Cuba or something like this, and he goes on a boat to Cuba. So fine, you know, he makes a big deal out of the fact that he's an ambassador to Cuba. Then on the boat, he is elected by the fellow passengers to give the final toast to the captain. That gets a chapter, right? Like how his fellow passengers honored him with the election, this role. You know, so there's something, and so I can only see that as some kind of incredibly defensive working through of having been driven from office, right? That he has to keep reminding people of how honored he was at a moment when he's being denigrated left and right. So,
what year did he write that? Sorry.
Oh, God.
But he wrote that in the Jim Crow era.
Yeah. So, that's where the vulnerable stuff comes. Like, people are afraid to say certain things, I think, because they're still in the public eye. He's still a Republican Party power, and so he's sort of obscured.
So,
oh.
I have a thought. So, you know, one thing that strikes me is the sort of avoidance of discussing Reconstruction, or the troubling nature of discussing Reconstruction for African-American authors is, to me, Reconstruction at the end of the 19th century is toxic.
Yes.
It's a toxic discussion, especially for African Americans, because it has been so appropriated by a white supremacist narrative,
right,
that it almost becomes impossible to intervene. And once you start talking about it, it automatically calls up all of those images that have been so firmly embedded.
Right.
So that's why, you know, to me, I mean, I think the points that you make sense, but I also feel like there's that, you know, how, like, we don't even want to come near this conversation, and we don't even know how to begin to, you know, somehow change those stereotypes that have become so...
Right. So this gets me back to the part of your question I dropped before. I agree. Except that these authors happen to be very brave. So in their straight-up nonfictional writing, they defend Reconstruction. I mean, Charles Chestnut says, you are lying about Reconstruction because... you're doing it instrumentally to keep us down, right? I mean, it's not just let me defend Reconstruction, it's let me attack you for your attack on Reconstruction. Similarly, so then the question is, why can't they do it in their fiction? And in their fiction, you know, one thing that happens, I thought of this when you were talking about lynching, in Marrow of Tradition, is there is a pretty clear allusion to the fact that the insurgency was putatively caused by the difficulty of being Ida B. Wells, right, and talking about lynching, where she says it's unfair to lynch black men for raping white women when, in fact, we all know it's the reverse. And she then, that gets discussed in Chestnut's novel, right? So Chestnut's willing to talk about even more charged things like miscegenation and lynching and their connection in a way that... that somehow he can't talk about Reconstruction, which seems less... I agree it's toxic, but they're able to grapple with toxic stuff in other ways, and somehow they can with this.
Well, maybe you can grapple with toxic stuff when you're writing something that's clearly politically driven,
yeah,
but when you're in the realm of fiction and and the possibility of your reader imagining something, in, you know, then it becomes harder,
right,
to kind of even put the question on the table.
Right. So that would be really interesting, because that would be a question of literary market. And the fact that... So one claim I sometimes make about these authors that I didn't, because I thought, oh, everyone's just going to challenge me, but I sometimes think of them as the first generation of African-American authors, where they thought their primary role was to be authors rather than to be activists who also happened to write great books, like Frederick Douglass or something. So you could say, all right, so you're Frederick Douglass, and what you need to do in your what you need to do in your writing is... be an activist, right? These people are trying to get by as professional authors.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe what we're talking about is a shift from the African-American author as primarily a reformer to an actual professional author, and that's where reconstruction becomes a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Would that make sense?
Well, I think it does.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe to stay on the issue of genre a little bit, I'm wondering if there's a kind of instrumentality that literature can perform, or that these authors saw that literature might perform, that is different than the kind of instrumentality of engaging in sort of, you know, no-hold-barred, partisan, political polemic.